Have you found you're reading the paper differently these days? I mean, the news section's pretty grim at the moment. There's talk of recession, unemployment's up, and Access Economics reckons the budget is buggered, which I believe is a technical term. The Treasurer confirms the budget will be in deficit this year. It's enough to send you straight to the comics and the crossword or the sport. And you might have good economic justification to do just that. You'll hear about it shortly. To discuss the psychology of the current economic crisis and the dangers of deflation, I'm joined once again by Oliver Hartwich, a research fellow in the economics program at the Centre for Independent Studies. The CIS, you'll recall, has a pro-market, small government view of the world. And also with me is David Hetherington, the executive director of the public policy think tank Per Capita. They describe themselves as progressive. Oliver, welcome back.
Good morning.
Let me start with you. The psychology of the economic crisis. Why is the way we look at this so important?
Because Homo economicus, after all, is a human being, and humans tend to be interested in things that go on around them. And if you see things that make you feel better, you may feel better about your economic prospects as well. And at the moment, it's quite a difficult time, because whenever you open a newspaper or whenever you switch on the radio or TV, you are bombarded with these economic doom and gloom stories. And it's really, really difficult to feel good about yourself. And that's why I think we are really talking ourselves down into a crisis. We're making it worse for ourselves.
David, what do you think? Do you agree?
I do agree. I think we overdid the optimism during the kind of period of the boom, and I think there's a danger that we overdo the pessimism now. We can't shut out the real economic news. Job losses are real. Economic contraction is real. But there's a danger that we can talk down our own prospects, and in doing so, actually make things worse.
So just as too much optimism can lead to a bubble, too much pessimism can lead to what?
I wouldn't say that. Too much pessimism can't lead to a collapse, but it can make a collapse worse.
Right. All right. So, Oliver, in terms of our economic future, how important is that capacity to regain some optimism or to retain the optimism we have?
Well, perhaps we should talk about the sports then. There was interesting economic research coming out of Germany at the time of the last Soccer World Cup in 2006. Remember, it was a Soccer World Cup that was hosted in Germany. It was a big national event, and for 4 or 5 weeks, the whole country went completely ecstatic about football and talked about nothing else. And the interesting thing was that economists at the time were asking the Germans about economic prospects, what they thought the future holds for them. And there was nothing else going on in the world but soccer. And strangely enough, the Germans became more optimistic by the day as their team went on a winning streak. And, doesn't really matter whether your team beats Argentina in a penalty shootout. At least it doesn't do anything for your economic prospects, but that's what the Germans believed. And the economic researchers from Bonn University even managed to put a figure to it. They said that this extra optimism derived from the World Cup was worth just about 23.5% in extra income. In order to get the same degree of optimism, you would have had to increase income for the average German household by 23%. I mean, that's extraordinary. And it shows you what a power psychology is. People were suddenly feeling better simply because their team won and they thought the economy was doing better.
What about, you can understand how in the euphoria of things, and I was in Sydney for the Olympics and also a few years later when we had the Rugby World Cup here, and as a sports fan and a rugby fan in particular, it did feel positive and optimistic. But how long does the effect last?
Well, I think in the case of Germany, it lasted quite a while. Only recently, just last month, unemployment actually went up again in Germany after years in which it was reduced from 5 million to just under 3.5 million. But I think what we could learn is it is just not something that only applies during World Cups. It's something that applies in everyday economics as well. People need to feel good about something because otherwise they get very pessimistic and depressed. And in these times when we are confronted with these doom and gloom stories, we should perhaps just look at the things that are still going right. We have, for example, falling prices, which may be a good thing for people because they can suddenly afford more. We have falling petrol prices, which you can feel at the pump and it makes your life a bit easier. You can see that mortgage rates have come down. So if you're a first timer, not only that you get an increased first by a government grant, but you also pay less in your mortgage repayments. So I think it really works. You have to see that there are some positive stories out there.
We'll come back to the bigger picture in a minute. But David, the German research, how convinced are you?
The first thing to say is heaven help us if this holds for Australia. Because
you're talking about the cricket.
The wheels are falling off our cricket team. A grand slam in tennis is as far away as it's ever been. And Great Britain beat us in the Olympics. So if we're looking to sporting success for economic recovery, I think we're looking in the wrong place. An interesting local comparison with the German research is New Zealand's response to losing the Rugby World Cup. Famously in 1999, the government was turfed out against expectation on the back of a Rugby World Cup loss a couple of weeks before the election. So I think in the short term, this effect can work in both ways. It can work on the positive.
Yes.
And it can work on the positive, as in the German case, where sentiment, public sentiment rises, and on the negative, where sporting failure leads to a general gloom descending. I think, though, the effect is short-lived, and I'm not sure that it does carry on for months and years, as Oliver suggests. I think the particular case with Germany, you see that Germany was the host of the World Cup, so there's an enormous influx of visitors and spending and economic activity that flows on from that, which could be part of the economic performance that we've seen there. But I think the ability of economic news more broadly to overcome sporting success on the field, particularly from the national team, is pretty strong.
On Life Matters today, we are talking about the state of the economy with two regular economic commentators, David Hetherington, who's executive director of the Per Capita Think Tank, and Oliver Hartwich, who's a research fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies. We have been talking, David, about optimism and how valuable it is, but it occurs to me that optimism and a particular tendency to be a Pollyanna about risk in the US mortgage markets is how we've gotten into this mess in the first place.
That's right. People are generally poor judges of risk. We look at plane crashes and car crashes in two completely different ways. We feel that plane flights are particularly high-risk activity, and car travel is particularly low-risk activity, when that's not the case. And it seems that that poor perception of risk has played itself out in our financial markets, such that people who felt they were particularly good judges of risk packaged up financial debt in new and complex ways, and really misjudged how risky some of these assets were, and that's led to the situation we find ourselves in today.
Oliver. I think you can even draw that a bit further. It's not just that people compare car crashes and plane crashes. Take the lottery. Winning the lottery is probably even less likely than crashing on a plane, but people seem to believe in that. When you buy a lottery ticket, you always think, well, what am I going to do with the $20 million I win in cash? Well, you don't really think when you board a plane, well, I'm going to fall off the sky in next minute.
Yes, I'm occasionally acutely aware of the difference in probabilities of these events occurring, because I'm a not regular but a semi-regular purchaser of a $4.90 ticket. It's part of my recreation budget, and I always imagine what I could do with the money, and I never imagined that I could be killed in a car crash, which is much more likely.
Yeah, because my wife always tells me to get them because she believes in that, so what chance do I have?
Well, let's move on to other things. We've already discussed, that sport can make you feel more optimistic, and optimism's worth 23% in income. Would you not take the money, though, Oliver?
Well, last week, I must admit, my German soccer team reached the quarterfinal of the German FA Cup, and it made me wonder whether I wouldn't have taken 23% instead.
David, you take the money.
I think I'd take the sporting success personally, but I don't think we're talking about money here. I think the research Oliver's pointing to talks about an increase in consumer sentiment, well-being. It's not something that translates directly into cash. And I think were it something that turned into a pile of notes on the table, then we'd feel differently. But I don't think, unfortunately, we can extend the sporting metaphor that far.
Let's move on then, because there has been money. The Australian government has dished out money. There was money before Christmas, which we talked about before on the show. Since then, there's been money for the car industry. There's also been money for the commercial property industry. The government cabinet meets today, and they will almost certainly, I think they've pretty much said, we're talking about what we do next. Have they gone so far, Oliver?
Well, we got figures coming out only last Friday that showed that consumer credits have shrunk for the first time in many, many years in Australia, which seems to suggest that people were just using the stimulus, the extra money they got in December, to repay some credit card bills, which in itself may be a good thing, but it shows you that the government stimulus package didn't quite work in the way that they had intended to. And I think there's a reason for that. The reason is that people saw this government stimulus package as a one-off, And they thought, well, in the end, I'll probably have to repay that money with extra taxes. So they were quite wisely taking the money, repaying their debt, because they didn't really bank on it that they could keep it in the long run.
You're making ordinary people sound disconcertingly like economists, Oliver, and we know that that's not the case.
Well, we all know that ordinary people are sometimes a bit more intelligent than even economists, and I think they're making just rational decisions.
All right, David, let's do the wider question. So far, the stimulus packages, what do you think?
I think the broad-based stimulus packages are a really good idea. I think that's the way that we need to kickstart economic activity again. I don't think it's a bad thing that consumer credit shrunk for the first time in 15 years last quarter. In fact, for a long time now, we've been trying to get consumers weaned off consumer credit. And the trade-off is how much of a stimulus dollar you pay down your credit card and how much of a stimulus dollar you use to go out and spend at the shops. And both of those things are pushing the economy in the right direction. Different people make different choices about the split, but paying down debt and getting the economy kickstarted through consumer activity are both positive economic developments.
What do you think should be in the next package? Because it was interesting to me this morning to hear Heather Ryder on Radio National Breakfast basically talk about things like education and training, what you might call soft infrastructure.
I think that's exactly the kind of spending we're looking for. I think what you're doing when spending on soft infrastructure is making the investment in the long-term value creation that the country needs. And I think that's something we haven't done for quite a long time now. I think another element of the package will be tax cuts at the low end of the scale. And I was fascinated last week to hear the Business Council call for low-income earners tax cuts and eschew a corporate tax cut, which must be a first. And I think, again, that's going in the right direction. You're putting more money into the wallets of people who have high share of basic consumer spending in their household budgets, and you want to get them out there spending those dollars and paying down debt if they can.
Oliver.
Well, I think we have to be very careful, though, because just last night the Treasurer announced that he thinks the budget is definitely going to be in the red this year. And we can see the dangers in all this deficit spending in some other economies around the world. You just have to look at the German economy heading for a 4% budget deficit this year. In Britain, we are looking at 10%. In America, it's probably up to 15% of budget deficits. I think we have to be careful that we're not slipping into this kind of territory, because in the end, some future taxpayers will have to pay it back.
You'd be good about the tax cuts, though, wouldn't you? I mean,
no, I think at this time, we would even have to be very careful about tax cuts. But if it comes to a fiscal stimulus package, I think there are some economists out there who believe that it would be better to have credible long-term tax cuts rather than some discretionary infrastructure spending where the government probably just wants to pump out the money without really knowing what it's doing at the moment.
So are you, in fact, almost arguing that some of the emergency measures, and perhaps even some of the language going back to the first point on psychology that the government are using, are not helping?
Yes, I think that's precisely the problem, because we are currently creating that kind of crisis feeling, crisis talk, and panic even. And with every emergency measures that governments around the world put in place, they're basically admitting that they can't really do much about the economy, because otherwise they would have solved it already. And I think we should really focus more on some fundamentals that are still looking quite good, I think, for Australia. And therefore, we should really stop this crisis talk, stop these emergency measures, and really try to settle down.
It occurs to me that governments always like to kind of manufacture a state of crisis and then on top of that convey a feeling that they are in charge. And it's a rare government, or perhaps a rarer politician, who either just doesn't feel confident doing that. I'm thinking of Gordon Brown, who always sounds like everything's terrible all the time, even when he was doing rather well as Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer. Now he's Prime Minister there, and it still sounds like everything's terrible all the time.
Let me take your first point, Richard. I think it's a stretch to argue that this crisis is manufactured by politicians.
No, I didn't say it was manufactured. I mean, they love to kind of talk up the fact that it's terrible, but I'm here, so it'll be all right.
That's true. But when there are 85,000 job cuts in a single day around the world last week, you know that this crisis isn't manufactured. You're right, though, that politicians love crafting a response to a crisis, particularly one that makes them look all-powerful. And Gordon Brown has a manner suited to the times. He's very dour. He's very measured. He's not exuberant, optimistic.
The heir of an undertaker who's not quite convinced that the client will have the money to pay.
Yeah, he's the son of a Scottish preacher. And
doesn't seem to help him at the moment. He's still 12% behind in the polls.
That's as a result of the new difficulties that British banks are facing. But last year in October, when the crisis first came about, he enjoyed an enormous resurgence in the polls.
Let's talk about deflation, because this is something people are beginning to worry about. Which of you wants to take this one? I think we should first of all be clear on what it is, because as I understand of it, standard, part of it is prices being lower. Mm. Now, in a way, that doesn't sound like a bad thing.
Well, and I think we should perhaps take the panic out of the deflation talk as well. If you go back far into history, you see, for example, that the 19th century saw Britain's economy experiencing almost permanent deflation. And that was, of course, a time when Britain boomed. Or think of your own personal experiences. I don't know how often you buy personal computers, but you probably know that feeling that you buy one and you know perfectly well that in a year's time you would get something that's cheaper and better and you still buy it.
In a month's time, actually.
Well, yeah, probably, yes, that's true. So I think we should not be too overly pessimistic about the deflation prospects. And apart from that, we see central banks around the world pumping in loads of money into the markets. So even if we see some kind of deflation now, and I think mainly because of falling petrol prices, oil prices, that may be a very temporary thing. In the long run, with all the money being pumped in, I think inflation will be the main problem.
David?
I disagree. I think deflation is a real threat over the next 2 or 3 years. And there are two main problems with deflation. One is asset prices falling, particularly when those asset prices are secured against a debt. So if you have a mortgage of $500,000 and the collapse of a housing bubble means that your house price or your house value falls from 500 to 450 to 400, the value of your debt doesn't change.
Negative equity,
exactly right. The other threat is not that prices, consumer prices, fall in isolation, but that wages begin to fall too. And then you've got a deflationary spiral.
Japan's been going through
that. That's right. Japan's had that for 20-odd years, running from the mid-'80s through to the early 2000s. And what you see is a situation wherein returns to Japanese pensions, something in the order of negative 7% over a 20-year cycle. And what that means, if you invest $100,000 in a pension in 1985, it's worth something like $7,000 or $8,000 today.
Gentlemen, I want to keep going with this, but we do have to wrap it up. Thank you both for joining me. I hope I can persuade you to come back again fairly shortly. My guests have been David Hetherington, who's the Executive Director of Per Capita, and Oliver Hartwich, who's a Research Fellow in the Economics Program at the Centre for Independent Studies.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.